The following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. If you're in the Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services, or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. And now, here's Pastor Alan.
What does real faith look like? Faith is a word we throw around a lot in our culture. It's used in a lot of different ways. We say, well, according to my faith, or we talk about having an article of faith, or we're told to have faith, or to keep the faith, or to make a leap of faith. We're talking about somebody who is acting in good faith, or somebody who's acting in bad faith. We say that person has lost their faith, or this person has a deep faith, or that person's faith has been restored. It wouldn't surprise you to know that the word faith plays a big role in the Bible. As we have walked through the Gospel of John these last several weeks, you've probably noticed that the idea of faith is a big part of what John talks about. For example, John 1:7, he says, he came as a witness to testify to the light so that we might believe through him. In John 1:12, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name. Or, of course, we can't forget John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And you say, Pastor, that's a different word. No, it's not. As far as I know, especially in John 3:16, that is the same Greek word that is translated in other parts of the New Testament as faith. John actually uses that word some 81 times in his gospel, which, by the way, is more than the other three gospel writers combined. But what does that mean? What does it mean to believe or to have faith? In John 4, verses 43 through 54, we're given a great illustration of what real faith looks like. We're also given some ideas about what real faith is not. So I hope you'll join me this morning as we walk through that passage and learn what real faith is and what it looks like. And I think once you get a good grasp on that, it makes the whole Christian message just kind of open up. One thing that real faith is not mere knowledge. Okay, that's one thing it's not. Look, starting at verse 43. After 2 days, he went forth from there into Galilee. For Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. So, if you remember, Jesus spent a couple days with the villagers of Sychar in the region of Samaria, teaching them what it means to worship God in spirit and truth, teaching them about how to imbibe of that living water. And after a couple days, he bids them goodbye, and he resumes his journey towards Galilee, which is that northern section of the area of the Jewish homeland there. And John tells us the reason he is making that trip, that word for, very important, is because Jesus, he was so intent on getting to Galilee, presumably, or apparently, it was his belief that a prophet has no honor in his own country. Now, this verse has generated quite a bit of debate over the centuries, and this is why. Because the other three gospel writers also mention this thought, only they mention it in connection with an incident that happened in Jesus' hometown, the Galilean village of Nazareth. And in that incident, Jesus had declared his public ministry before his hometown only to face resistance from some of his neighbors. We've all heard the expression, familiarity breeds contempt, right? When I was considering coming to be your pastor 16 years ago, one of the things that gave me pause was the challenge of trying to minister in a place where everybody had watched you be young and stupid. Obviously, Jesus didn't have to worry about that. But, you know, it's an intimidating kind of thing. We're also told in that context, on the other three Gospels, that he was not able to do many miracles in Nazareth because of their unbelief. Okay, so everybody just naturally assumes when you come across this passage in John chapter 4, must be talking about the same thing, right? But here's the problem. Jesus was leaving Judea, the southern part of the region, and he's traveling back to Galilee, where he grew up. And so John is portraying Jesus as going back to the neighborhood where he grew up because people were refusing to believe him back in Judea. So that is a little confusing here. It's not quite what the other three gospel writers are talking about. So how do we square that circle? And to make things even more complicated, we get to verse 45, and it sounds like some of these Galileans are actually excited that Jesus is coming back because they want to see some more of these miracles. Okay, so how do we solve that? Well, it's like this. Notice he says here, a prophet has no honor in his own country, okay? His own country there, Jesus is referring to the Jewish nation as a whole. Judea in general, and Jerusalem in particular, represented the heart of Jewish society. That was the home office for world Judaism. And the name Jew actually comes from the tribe of Judah, which gave us later Judea. And that goes back at least to the 5th century B.C. In Jerusalem resided some of the best and brightest minds of Judaism. And these men pored over the scriptures. They memorized entire passages, could quote them from memory. And they debated these passages ad nauseum. So if there was anybody who should have been prepared to recognize God's anointed, guess where they should have been? In Jerusalem. And yet, by and large, most of these supposedly learned men rejected Jesus. Later, many of them are actually going to call for his death. Even after God validated Jesus' ministry by raising him from the dead, many of them still refused to believe, even though they had all this knowledge, because Jesus didn't fit their neat little carefully constructed understanding of how God was supposed to work. Merely possessing knowledge is not faith. Just having a set of facts is not genuine faith. You can know a lot about Jesus and sadly still not know Jesus at all. You can even profess to believe that Jesus existed, but that doesn't guarantee you have a personal relationship with him. As we're reminded by Jesus' own half-brother in James 2, verse 19, here's a little newsflash for you. Even the demons believe in Jesus, and they're scared to death of him because his existence represents their judgment. So knowledge is not enough. There's more to faith than just knowledge. Real faith is also more than an emotional response to seeing God show up. In verse 45, so when he came to Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they themselves also went to the feast. So Jesus arrives back in Galilee, and he's recognized by other Galilean pilgrims who've just gotten back from the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the same feast that Jesus had attended in Jerusalem. And these people, while they were there in Jerusalem, they had perhaps heard Jesus teach. They had witnessed some of the things he did. You know, and even though John talks about, you know, the first sign at the wedding of Cana, and this will be the second sign we're getting ready to see, he also tells us Jesus did a lot of other stuff too. There were healings and things like that. And these people saw all these things. Some of them may have actually been there in the temple that day when Jesus chased all the merchants out and created such a spectacle. And so, wow, he's in our town? Man, we want to see some more. John implies they were excited to realize this wonder worker was bringing his show to their hometown. It's kind of like when you're on vacation and maybe you're walking around, you pass by a park and there's a band playing out there and you stop and listen and you say, hey man, those guys are pretty good. I'm kind of enjoying this. And then you get home and you see a poster letting you know that band is coming to perform in your hometown. Hey, let's go get some tickets. Let's go hear these guys again. They're excited. They want to see the show. And some people, that's all they're drawn to is the show. Okay? However, what happens to people's interest when the show's over? They head for the exits, don't they? There's a saying, whatever brought them there is what's going to keep them there. You know, and I don't want to be critical, but there are some churches where it's all about the show. People are drawn in because they get an emotional buzz from the music or the preaching or the production. And don't misunderstand me. I'm all for good music. I'm all for good preaching. And I'm all for using technology wisely to make sure that we enhance people's experience so they can hear the gospel clearly and being creative and all that. I have no problem with that. unless it becomes the point. Because the point should be Jesus. If that's all you have is the show, then what are you left with when the band breaks up or the preacher retires or has a bad day or the technology breaks, as sometimes happens? You know, what happens if you come in and, you know what, the worship team wasn't quite on there. I mean, ours did a great job today, but you come in and you say, what happens if the worship team's not quite on today? Does that mean you didn't worship? You know, I didn't get much out of the service today. Well, good, we weren't worshiping you. You know, hopefully God got a lot out of it. You know, if you build a church around a spectacle, then you're constantly having to make the spectacle bigger and more exciting in order to keep people's attention. If you build a church around a personality, what happens when that personality is no longer available? You know, a sad little truth here, I'm coming to realize more and more, none of us are getting any younger. Okay? Maybe you are, but I know I'm not. And I hope it's a long time from now, but there'll come a day when I have to shift gears, okay? And if you're looking at me and building everything around me, we're going to be in trouble. And I've seen churches where that's happened. I could mention some names of some churches where I know that's happened. Some in our community. Or what happens if you build your feeling about Jesus around your emotional feelings? What happens when your feelings don't meet up with your expectations? You're having a bad day. Now, maybe it's not the worship service. Maybe it's not what God's doing in your life. Maybe it's because you didn't get enough sleep last night. Well, I guess God didn't show up today. Got news for you. He's here. You can't go anywhere and get away from God. Now, maybe you're not tuned in with him today, but you can't get away from him. He's here. But if you're basing everything on how you feel, there's going to be days where you're going to be disappointed, or you're going to be depressed, or maybe you're carrying a burden that's threatening to block your vision of God. And, you know, you can't base everything on just your feelings or the emotional buzz you're getting from the service. And I'm glad, man, there's sometimes I get so excited, I hear a song, it really moves me, and man, I just want to praise Jesus. But if that's what you're basing your faith on, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be let down. Do you come for the show or do you come for the Savior? There's another expression. You know, it's not how high you jump, it's how straight you walk when you land, right? He cannot be Lord over your mountaintops unless you are also willing to walk with him through some of those dark valleys. So faith is not just an emotional response. Real faith is more than coming to God simply for what you can get from him. Look at verse 46. Therefore, he came again to Cana of Galilee, where he'd made the water wine. And there was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and was imploring him to come down and to heal his son, for he was at the point of death. And Jesus said to him, unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply will not believe. So Jesus comes back to Cana. Remember, that's where he turned the water into wine at the wedding. John says that was the first big sign, kind of announcing his public ministry. And while he was there, he's sought out by an official from the court of King Herod Antipas. Now, actually, Herod wasn't a king. He administered the area of Galilee on behalf of the Roman Empire. And this was probably a minor official because he's living in Capernaum, which is about 25 miles away from where Antipas' capital was located in Tiberias. They're both on the coast of the Sea of Galilee, but it's quite a journey to get from one to the other. So this father, who has this official job, this important position, he makes a 25-mile trek uphill because Capernaum is on the coast. Cana is up in the mountains. It's like walking from Lakeside to Signal Mountain. He walks all the way up there, or maybe he rides, we don't know. But he gets to Capernaum. His son is deathly ill, and in the Greek here, he is literally begging Jesus, Master, please come back with me. My son is about to die. He is expressing the hope that this Jesus, who had done all these wonderful signs, can do at least one more and make his son well. And the thing he wants most of all at this moment is for Jesus to travel back with him to Capernaum and lay hands on his son. Now, look at Jesus' reply. Wow, that seems a little harsh, isn't it? Unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply won't believe. Now, on the surface, Jesus' words can look a little cruel. However, when we dig down, we see that Jesus is actually making a very important point here. And note that his comments here are not addressed specifically to the Father. In your English translation, it may say, you people. That's because our English translations sometimes suffer a little bit because English does not have a second person plural pronoun like a lot of other languages do. And that's what, you know, when people make fun of us Southerners all the time for saying y'all. Hey, we're just trying to help give English something that the rest of the world already has, okay? In the Greek, which this was originally written in, Jesus uses a second person plural pronoun. He is talking about you all you people. You people just, all you want is more miracles. I see just throwing the hands up. All you want is more miracles. Now, is that not how many of us treat God? Let's be honest. Some people say, God, I'll believe in you as long as my heart's happy, as long as my family's intact, as long as my health's good, as long as my pantry is full, as long as my bank account is flush, as long as my life is easy, Lord, I'm yours. That's a lot like the situation we read about in the book of Job, is it not? Job chapter 1. You know, God's having this great council with all these supernatural beings, and Satan finds his way in there. And God's bragging on Job, his servant, says, hey, have you seen my buddy Job? And Satan looks at him and says, hey, the only reason he loves you is because all the stuff you give him. You let me take away some of that stuff, and we'll see how much he praises you then. And so the whole rest of the book of Job is God giving Satan permission to take away everything Job had except his life and trying to get him to curse God and die. And he gets to the end of the book when Job has lost everything and he's just about at his breaking point, and God shows up and says, Job, you don't know what you're talking about. You just sit down and be quiet and just trust me. In essence, that's what he tells him. See, you can say, God, I'll serve you as long as things are good, but what about when your heart is depressed and anxious? What about when your family is falling apart? What about when your body is betraying you? What about when your pantry is empty and your bank account is bankrupt? What about when your life is hard? Do you still believe then? Or are you just in it for what you can get for yourself? Once we understand this truth, we understand what really Jesus is trying to do in this statement, okay? He is indicting the fickle faith of those who only want God for what they can get from him. And he's testing this frightened father to see what kind of faith he really has, okay? This is a test. As I used to say in my radio days, this is only a test. And this is where we see what real faith is. Because real faith is an actual trust in God. Look at verse 49. The royal official said to him, Sir, and the Greek word there is actually Lord, Kyrios, Lord. Lord, come down before my child dies. And Jesus said to him, Go, your son lives. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and started off. So here we see what real faith is. This father is undeterred. He gets this rude response from Jesus, but he's still clinging to the hope that Jesus could come and save his son. So Jesus gives him another test. He says, go. Notice what he doesn't do. He doesn't come down and say, I'll go with you. He just says, go. Your son lives. So now this dad has a dilemma. He has a choice he has to make. Does he sit there and continue to beg Jesus to do something to come with him? Or does he trust Jesus, take him at his word, and obey? What's he going to do? Well, in verse 50, we see he did what? Somebody tell me. He believed. He believed the word that Jesus spoke. The actual Greek word here is the word pisteos. And that's the predominant word used in the New Testament for faith. And a good example is Hebrews 11, verse 6. Which says, and without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of those who seek him. In that verse, both faith and believe are forms of the Greek word pisteo. The corresponding Hebrew word, which is used throughout the Old Testament, is the word haman, which literally means to place confidence in. Or if it's used, it can also be used of somebody that they are worthy of having confidence placed in them. That's why so often you see it translated as faithful. Both those words have the idea of putting your weight on something, of leaning on it and trusting on it to hold you up. When we've spoken of a person, it's a person you can have confidence in that they're going to do what they've told you they're going to do. Real faith is based on trust. God tells us something. And the question is, do we consider God trustworthy enough to act on what he has told us? See, Jesus didn't come to be your vending machine. Jesus didn't come to be your genie in the bottle. Jesus didn't come to be your concierge. Jesus didn't come to be your get out of jail free card. Jesus presents God with us. Literally, God walking among us, and that alone makes him worthy of our trust. And the question is, will we lean on him? Will we listen to him? And will we obey him based on that trust? Now, how do we know that this father really believed in Jesus? Well, that tells us something else about real faith. Real faith is demonstrated in action and obedience. Again, going back to the end of verse 50, he believed the word Jesus spoke to him, and he started off. And as he was going down, because he was going back down to Capernaum, his slaves met him saying his son was living. So the father gets this word from Jesus, go, your son will live. He believes, and what does he do? He starts off. Real faith has knowledge, but it also is coupled with action. Knowledge plus action. The gospel proclaims to us, we are saved by faith in Jesus, not by our works. Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one can boast. Okay? But the very next verse, we find out that it is through our works that our faith is demonstrated to be genuine. Because in Ephesians 2:10 it says, for we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works. What comes first? The faith. See, often, you know, people who don't know the Lord try to put the works in front. You know, I gotta get God's attention. I gotta please God. I gotta make God happy with me. I gotta buy God off. You're never gonna be able to do that. You can never be good enough. But God offers us salvation through Jesus, and we accept that through faith, believing, resting, relying on the promise that God has given us. And then that transforming relationship of faith produces in us the fruit of faith, which is good works. We begin to change our behavior in alignment with our knowledge and our trust. And that's what this father does. He decides, I'm going to trust Jesus. I'm going to believe he is trustworthy. It is through our actions that we demonstrate our trust in Jesus. That's why James could later say in James 2:26, faith without works is dead. Okay? How is your faith being demonstrated in your life right now? Are you acting in trust and in faith? Because if you're living by faith, let me tell you something else real faith does. Real faith impacts others. Back to verse 51, as he was going down, his slaves met him, saying that his son was living. And he inquired of them the hour when he began to get better. They said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. So the father knew it was at the hour in which Jesus said to him, your son lives. And he himself believed, and his whole household. This is again a second sign that Jesus performed when he had come out of Judea into Galilee. So as the man's traveling back, that long 25-mile journey back to Capernaum, he runs into some of his servants who are racing up the hill with some good news, boss. Your son is going to be just fine. They started comparing notes. What time did he start feeling better? And they figured it out. It was about 1 in the afternoon. And he says, well, you know, that's exactly the time Jesus told me your son's going to live. And he is so excited because his faith has been deepened, and he begins to testify to his household. And what happens to them? They begin to believe based on his testimony. And they all come to believe in Jesus. When we display our faith in Jesus by the way we conduct our lives, other people are drawn to Jesus as well. When we choose the priorities of Jesus over the values of this world, people take notice. When we serve others instead of demanding our own way, people take notice. When we choose to forgive and endure rather than to seek retaliation, other people take notice. When I was in high school, within my friend group, I was known for being a believer. And, you know, I wasn't perfect, but there were certain lines I wouldn't cross because of my faith. And there was another guy in our friend group. I wouldn't really call him a friend of mine, but he was in our friend group. And he used to mock me all the time. He was an atheist. At least he said he was. And he used to give me the roughest time. In fact, he labeled me in our friend group with a really crude nickname. And he said, the only way I'm going to stop calling you that is if you go get a girl pregnant. And I'm like, well, that's kind of a stupid way to get rid of a nickname. So I guess I'll just be known by that nickname. You know, we get to the last couple weeks of school and everybody's got their yearbooks out, passing them around, you know, our senior year. And the last time a lot of us are going to see each other, he wrote a note for me in my yearbook. And I don't remember the exact words. I have to go look it up. But the gist of it was, man, I made your life miserable, but I want you to know I really respect you for the stand you took and the consistency you showed. Whoa. What are other people seeing in you that could draw them to Jesus? What does real faith look like? Like this father. Now, I got to come up with some new illustrations. I'm sorry, I keep going back to this one because so far I have not found anything better. Okay, so I'm going to use it one more time and then I'm going to put it on the shelf for a while and try to find something different. But if you've been around me very long, you've heard me talk about the Disney film Aladdin. Okay, maybe it's because I had kids when that film came out, but there's a scene that occurs, or a sequence that occurs twice in that film. Both times, it's similar circumstances, but different contexts. In both situations, Aladdin is standing on a ledge, okay? In front of him is open space. Behind him, the bad guys are getting ready to come through the door. And so he reaches his hand back to Princess Jasmine, and do you remember what he tells her? Do you trust me? Okay? Now, Princess Jasmine has to make a choice. Does she take Aladdin by the hand and follow him over the ledge, not knowing if there's anything out there? Or does she take her chances with the bad guys getting ready to bust through the door? Man, what an illustration of faith. Because Jesus reaches out his hand to us and says, I know you can't see what lies around the bend, but do you trust me? And when we take Jesus by the hand and begin to walk with him day by day, even into the unknown, that makes all the difference in the world. And that is what real faith looks like. I hope you're walking with Jesus. I hope you're trusting Jesus with every part of your life. I hope you've invited him into your family, into your workplace, into your personal time, into those dark spaces where you have those troubling thoughts. Grab Jesus' hand and hold on tight, because he will carry you through.
If you enjoyed this program, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thanks for listening.